You to live. He's not just telling you something for his own health. He doesn't just want you to, is that a bad word? Shut up. He doesn't want you to shut up and listen. He just wants you to, there are reasons behind his commandments. He wants you to live. He wants good things for you. And that's underneath every commandment that he gives you. Now, like we said in class this morning, if you don't get it, shut up and do it, all right? Like, if you can't understand the commandment, if you're not sure why he's telling you to do what he's telling you to do, you should do it anyway. And just like my children, if they don't know why I'm telling them not to touch the hot stove, they should still do it. It's still going to be in their best interest, even if they don't understand it. Even if it seems like I'm trying to keep a really cool, glowing red thing from them, and I'm not letting them play with it, and I'm a mean dad for not letting them touch the hot stove, even if that's their perspective or our perspective as it relates to God, you should still do it. So we're not going anywhere below that floor. If a command is a command, you should do the command, right? You should listen to God. However, God doesn't just want robots. He could have built those. He wants relationship. And because he wants a relationship with us, there are reasons behind these commands, and he's given us a book that lets us understand him, lets us understand his word and his command, and it strengthens, it bolsters the relationship between us and him. So unlike your parents who smacked you when you asked why, our God is begging us to ask him why. Why? God, why? Why can't we do that? Because when we ask why, and we step into this wrestling match with the text, when we do, like we talked about in class, when we do the Psalm 1 thing, when we meditate on God's law day and night, which I'm talking to you about it today, and hopefully you'll think about it tonight so we can check both boxes. When we do this, when we wrestle with the text, the hope is that the text wins and whips us into shape and makes us look more like Jesus when it's done with us, okay? That's what this wrestling match, this meditation, that's what asking why of God's commandments is meant to do to us. It's meant to shape us, transform us, make us look like people who are for life, who are more like God. And so we're doing that with the Ten Commandments today, with the first of the Ten Commandments today. So Exodus 20, like we already said, that's where our first commandment, the Ten Commandments start. Like I said, they're called the Ten Words. If you weren't in Bible class, the setting here is horrifying, awesome, incredible. The setting is that Moses was up on the mountain with God, and then he goes back down the mountain, and when he's at the bottom of the mountain, God from the mountain blasts the Ten Commandments out over everybody. And it's terrifying, and it's accompanied by lightning and thunder and a smoke and a trembling mountain and terrified Israelites. And they say in verse 18 of chapter 20, hey, tell God not to do that no more. We can't handle it. If he's got 600, which if you know, there are 613 laws in the Torah. If he's got 610 more of these, we're not going to live through them. Have him tell you, Moses, and then you tell us. And you know, I never thought about this until just now. You see what the people are asking for is a mediator in the relationship, a barrier, actually. God wanted to tell it to them, and they said, we need some space. That's what we need. We just need some space. So how do you tell Moses, and Moses, you can come tell us. It's kind of a sad, heartbreaking thing if you start to think about it in those terms. But that's what happens. These Ten Commandments are blasted from the mountain to the people. That's our setting. The very first commandment, back up to chapter 20 and verse 1. All right. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Now, which mountain are we at? It's not Bible class. It's a sermon, so I'm not supposed to let you answer. But Sinai. We're at Mount Sinai, which is just on the other side of the Red Sea, which is just on the other side of Egypt, which is where they were in slavery. So all of this just happened. And God feels the need to remind them at the very beginning of the Ten Commandments. Hey, don't forget who I am. I am the God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. I just rescued you guys. I am your rescuer, and I brought you up, so remember that first. Fun little housekeeping things, important things for you to know. In verse 2, most of your Bibles are going to have the word Lord in all caps, right? I am the Lord. That's God saying his name. There's an old tradition, goes a long, 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 long way back, that you don't write God's name. Instead, you write something as a placeholder. The Jews used to write Adonai, or in the Greek, it's kurios. It means Lord, and it is a substitute for God's name, Yahweh, Y-H-W-H, the Tetragrammaton. You'll write any of those down and look them up later. It's fun to study. But that's God's name. He says, I am Yahweh, your God, and I brought you out of the land of Egypt. He says, he starts with his name, who he is, and what he did, right? His reputation should precede him. That's kind of how this is starting. First command, chapter 20 and verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me. Oh, okay. Anybody have any questions? All right, stand and sing. Like, that's pretty straightforward, isn't it? Now it is, and I'm not making any light of that. And you know what? Like we said, if that's all we got, do it. Don't have any other gods before God. But then there's this other thought that comes to my mind is, well, there aren't any other gods, so this is even easier than I thought. There's just the one, and he's just going to be my God, and that's it. And then you realize that implicitly this text says that there are, maybe? Now, it doesn't actually say either way, but if you will have no other gods, then hold on a minute. Is the Bible teaching that there are other gods? Well, what's that word? You guys might have a word for gods here. Do you guys have a footnote by it? If you don't, that's okay. I'm going to tell it to you. I have my own footnotes I brought up with me. It's a lowercase g gods. This is, in Hebrew, the word Elohim. Elohim. All right? Elohim is a word that can be used to talk about Yahweh God. It's used in Genesis 1, in fact, to talk about in the beginning God. That's the word Elohim. However, it's also used in, I forget the chapter, 1 Samuel. It's when Saul goes and he goes to the witch of Endor, and he has Eli brought back up. If you don't remember this story, go read it. It's a wild story. Basically, Eli is a disembodied spirit conjured by the witch of Endor. Yes, that's in our Bible. And it calls Eli an Elohim. Okay, because this word is very flexible. It can be used to refer to Yahweh God. It can be used to refer to the gods of other nations. They're also called Elohim. It can be used to refer to Eli in that one story. It can be used to refer to angels. All right, now, okay, definitely don't exist, right? The other gods of other nations. Okay, we have complicated feelings about it, and most of us aren't super familiar with the story, but we don't think Eli turned into a god, so that's not what that word means there. I don't know about y'all, but most of us are, like, at least skeptical of ghosts. Third, angels. None of us are out on angels existing, right? We're all good with angels. Everyone's good with angels until they see them. Have you noticed that in the Bible? The second somebody sees an angel, they're like, oh, no, and then they think they're going to die. But for the most part, in our mental categories, like we've got a category for angels, which are not physical things, but are also not God. So when you see the word Elohim, that's kind of the idea that we're talking about. These non-physical forces, non-physical powers in the world that are not God, but are also not physical. Now, here's another spot that I think drives this home to remind us we do have a category for other gods. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 12, Paul's wrapping up his letter. He's getting all the way to the end of what he wanted to tell the church in Ephesus. And he says in verse 12, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers of this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Not gods, but not physical. So there seems to be this sort of third category for Paul of what we're going to use his language of spiritual forces. Now, what do we mean? What do those look like? What are spiritual forces? Well, if I asked, I'll never forget the first time I did this in a lesson. There was an 8-year-old boy. Oh, at the time he was five or six. He was little, too little to be paying attention. And he's sitting there coloring with his head all the way down. And I asked this question. I said, did anyone bring any peace with you today? Can someone pull peace out of your pocket and show it to me? And he goes like that and just throws it up in the sky like he was paying attention. And I loved it. It lit me up. I was like, that's what I'm talking about. He didn't understand a lick of it, but he was listening. And it's got to be where it starts, right? Listen, what is peace? You can't hold it, you can't touch it, but when you walk into a house that has it, you feel it, you know it. And conversely, when you walk into a house that does not, you feel it. Listen, okay, well, what is authority? I can't sell authority, can I? No, because authority is a thing that, like, it's not tangible. For some reason, all of you have kind of given it to me today by choosing not to talk when I'm talking and making me taller than I need to be. But, like, you know, it's not a physical thing, authority. It's a force, a spiritual force of authority. Peace, love, spiritual force. How about others, like desire? What is desire? And where does it even come from? And how do I know how much of it I have? They're not tangible. They're not physical things, but they're not God. They are spiritual forces. Are we all good with that? We got our category set. So when God says, "You'll have no other gods before me," is he teaching that there are other gods besides him? No, I don't think he is. I think we're right to understand him as the one God. However, there are other forces in the world who are spiritual forces, little g gods, spiritual forces, the language I'm going to keep using. And maybe what he's trying to teach is you will have no other spiritual force ahead of me. I think that's a pretty good message. All right, stand and sing, right? No, let's make it more complicated. All right, because if we just got done in Bible class saying that God's commands are for life, God wants us to have life, then we have a problem, because how in the world, this should be our first question, how is the command, "You will have no other gods before me," for life? How does that give us life? Because when I think about it, all this does is give me a new line that I now shouldn't cross. What I mean is, like the speed limit can't make you innocent, this command can't really, you know, give me life. It just tells me that if I cross over, I'm dead. And so when we ask about this and we're like, okay, well, you know, why should we keep God's command? Usually the answer we give is because of his smiting. His, you know, and we're reminded of the times when God smoted people, right? Who knows how to conjugate that appropriately? Anyone? Listen, we're reminded of times when God dealt very harshly with people like Uzzah, when the Ark of the Covenant was being brought back and it was falling, and Uzzah reached out and touched it, and boom, dead. Bye-bye, Uzzah. We're reminded of maybe Korah's rebellion, when the people of Israel rebelled against Moses and God, for that matter, and the earth opened up and swallowed them. That's how it's described. Maybe we're reminded of when the whole world was full of violence and everyone did what was right in their own eyes, and I can't get this out. Genesis chapter 6, you can read it for yourself. And we remember God flooding the whole world, and we think, oh, people didn't listen to God's commands, and he smote them. Yeah, okay. So how is that for life? Because all that sounds like is another way that I could be smited. I'm just going to pick a different one every time in case you haven't figured it out. Listen, here's an example I think is maybe helpful in this context. I am a parent. That is like one of the few identities that I cherish. I'm a parent, and I have four kids now. And one of the things I want to teach my kids, it's really important, don't hit. Now, we teach them that all the time, right? And then we go around and we wrestle or we play, and hitting is part of playing sometimes. So it's what I've tried to do is be a little bit more precise, and it's don't hit when you're angry, right? Don't hit when you're angry. And that has been very difficult for my hurricane of a two-year-old to figure out. Really, it's been hard for all of them. It's because it's a hard lesson for us. Don't hit when you're angry. Well, why do I teach them that? Because I don't want them to hit when they're angry, because it's not a good thing. And you know what I do right after that? What happens when they hit when they're angry? I hit them. I spank them. You know, as a parent, I have to wield the rod. Use the rod, beat the child. That's my motto. It's Matilda, 1995. You guys got to be up on your movies. Listen, why do I spank my kids when they hit? They hit and then they get, that seems a little counterintuitive, until you realize I really don't want them to be adults who hit when they're angry. And so what would happen if I don't punish them, if I don't expedite their punishment when they're young? If they don't learn, don't hit when you're angry, they're gonna keep hitting when they're angry, and then they're gonna get bigger. And when you hit when you're angry, that ends two ways, death or jail. Or maybe murder. I don't know. Maybe you're the one that hit and it goes better for you. I don't know if you can even count that as better. I'm on a tangent. You understand? Why do I spank my kids? Why do I punish them? Why am I expediting? Why am I smiting my children, to put it in the language of earlier? Like, because I don't want them to be adults who hit when they're angry, and I don't want them to be in prison or to be murderers or to be murdered. There it is. So I'm going to expedite the punishment in an effort to save their life in the future, right? So why is smiting on the table when God's commandments are supposed to be for life? Because they are. They are for life, because God wants us to learn and grow and change. So punishment, not always as anti-life as it seems. God is actually for life. So then we're left with the same question. How is this commandment for life? How does not having any other gods before me give us life? And I think the best way to answer this is by telling you that having another God, right? Having another spiritual force ahead of our God will kill you. Like, that suddenly makes this command really beneficial. Now, what do I mean? What does it mean to have another God before Yahweh God? What does it mean to worship or to serve another spiritual force other than our God? Well, let's start with some of the obvious ones. How about the spiritual force of greed, right? If we're going to serve our God, or we're going to serve another spiritual force, that means that we are giving all of our time, our attention, all of our effort. We're giving it our mind. We're giving it our service. We're doing things in service of that spiritual force. So how would that look if the spiritual force is greed? Well, it means I want more than I need. That's it. Simply, right? I want more than I need, so I'm going to go after more than I need. I'm going to work more hours, right? I'm going to lie, cheat, and steal, because if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. I'm going to make sure that, you know, I've got what I need, but I also want 2 cars, 3 cars, 4 cars, 8 watches, a house, 2 houses. I need a boat. Everyone needs a boat. All right, listen. We so often, if greed is our God, look around and want more than what we need. Do we need it? No. And you know what happens is sometimes we get so caught up in that like the line between need and want becomes really, really, really blurry. We start calling things we want needs. Like, my kids need shirts with their names on them. Nah, that's a want, right? Like, this is what I mean. So if greed is our God, then we go after things and we act in ways that worship our greed. Like I said, maybe we work long hours at the expense of our family. Maybe in an effort to get more than we have, we betray people. Our honesty is for sale if greed is our God. 1 Timothy chapter 6 says that the love of money is a root of all kinds of evils, and it's through that craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. Listen, if greed is your God, it kills you. It kills you. It's like the number one regret of rich people dying is, man, I wish I spent more time with the things that mattered in my life. What about pleasure? This is another probably pretty obvious one. What does it mean to want pleasure as your God, to serve pleasure as your God? Well, it could take a lot of different forms, but you know what they typically end up looking like? Addiction. I don't know if your desire for pleasure is in a sexual realm. I don't know if it's in a substance abuse realm. I'm not accusing anybody here, but if Sally Joe over here has a desire for pleasure, a worship of pleasure, is in service of feeling the best she can feel at all times, what's that going to look like? What's going to look like a life that is not pleasurable? It's going to look like a life that has been ravaged by a desire for feeling good. I just want to feel good. Well, if feeling good is your God, then what else is on the table? What are you willing to pay for feeling good? You gonna trade your kids in for how you feel? You gonna trade in your family? You gonna trade in your relationships? You're not a greedy person, right? So you're gonna give up all your money for feeling good. How often is that the story? When another spiritual force becomes our God, our life is ravaged. The spiritual force of pleasure, maybe it's the spiritual force of power. The Bible has a lot to say about the spiritual force of power. It says in James that God opposes the proud and gives grace to the humble. Jesus says in Mark chapter 9 that whoever wants to be first should be last, and the last will be first. And then Jesus says this really interesting thing in Matthew 26, after, you know, Peter whacks that guy's ear off. Jesus says, whoever takes the sword will perish by the sword. Whoever lives by the sword will die by the sword. Might be another translation of that. Well, what do we mean by that? Well, just think about how every empire in the history of the world has ended at the hands of another empire. Like, this is a truth about the world. This is how the world actually works. When you serve the God of power, and you desire power, and you desire reputation and authority, and that's what you want above everything else, well, guess what? Violence is on the table. And it becomes on the table very quickly, because it's a very efficient method of getting what you want, being bigger and stronger than people. It works really well in the short term. But then there's that, those who live by the sword will die by the sword. And eventually you're going to get old and weak, and somebody else is going to come after what you've got. Because when you serve power, when you desire to serve the God of power ahead of our God, it kills you. So how is God's command, you shall have no other gods before me, pro-life? Well, you know, serving these other gods, these other spiritual forces, they take from you, they kill you. But I also want to ask the question, what if we're serving a really good spiritual force? For example, what if peace is my God? What if I don't serve the God of peace, but peace, the spiritual force of peace, is A1, top tier, that's the spiritual force that I serve above all else. Well, how could that be bad, right? Well, let me tell you a story. Let me tell you a story about a man and a woman got married, all right? They got married, and this fella, well, his parents didn't teach him don't hit when you're angry. And so he hits when he's angry. Instead of his wife handling that, calling it out, being honest about that situation, she just wanted to keep the peace. And so when they had kids, hey, don't say that around Dad. And you know how Dad gets when he comes home from work. The whole house is walking on eggshells to keep the peace. It's never said, your dad shouldn't act like this. It's only ever said, don't tell people about this. Maybe the phrase is like, hey, we're trying to have a nice dinner. Don't bring that up. Come around. Hey, don't ruin the holidays. We want things to go well. If peace is your God at the expense of truth, it will kill you. That's a good thing, but it still could kill you. Well, okay, what about freedom? What if freedom is your God? I mean, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of slavery. We serve a God of freedom, right? We serve a God of freedom. So if freedom is our God, we should be all good. That should be like, no worries, right? Well, but if freedom is our God, at the expense of what? What about freedom at the expense of justice? What about freedom at the expense of right and wrong? Because if freedom is your God, you gotta let everyone be free, right? What about justice? What if justice is your God, and you become the judge, jury, and executioner of everyone you come into contact with? The problem with that is you're a really bad judge, and you got a pretty quick trigger on the execution thing. Justice at the expense of grace and mercy. Peace at the expense of truth. Freedom at the expense of justice. What about service at the expense of your family? I've seen this happen too, where serving other people was so important, it was such a priority, that the only people who weren't getting served were the people back at home. Listen, how is this command, you will have no other gods before me, how is that for life? Here's how. Our God is the only force in the existing world that when you give him your life, he gives it back to you tenfold. Every other spiritual force in the world takes from you and enslaves you and kills you. God said, I brought you out of slavery to be free. Paul says, you were set free, brothers, to be free. Don't go back to a life of slavery. If you choose to serve peace with your whole life, it'll kill you. If you choose to serve freedom, it'll kill you. If you choose to serve greed or power or pleasure, it will enslave you. When you're forced by a wicked taskmaster to go back to that same fountain of pleasure over and over again, it's not even pleasurable anymore. The only force in the entire existence that gives you life is our God. Everything else takes and kills and enslaves. The invitation is really simple here. Have no other gods before me. If you want life, like Jesus says in John chapter 10, if you want life abundantly, if you want the abundant life right now, it starts with the first commandment God gave his people in the Ten Commandments. Have no other gods before me. You know what that means? It means you don't worship your family before me. It means you don't worship greed before me. It means you don't worship peace before me. You don't worship peace. You worship the God of peace. And the peace that passes understanding will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. Invitation this morning. You will have no other gods before me, because listening to God's word, eat, leads you to life. Choosing what is good and evil for yourself, die, leads you to death. God says what is good for you is to have him as your God, the only one above everything else. That's not just for heaven, all right? You understand? That's not just for eternity. This isn't, like we talked about in Bible class, this isn't just about fire insurance. This isn't just about trying to save your soul. This is about right here today. If anybody wants to make this God the only God, the only God, to have no other gods before him today, you can do that today. We'll show you what the rest of the book says. This is the beginning. We started with one command. We'll show you what the rest of the book says. And you can see what that abundant life looks like in Jesus. If anyone needs prayers or anything from the church, we love you. So let us know what you need while we stand and while we sing.